many fronts in the argument against the existence of a god or gods and veracity of religious narratives. Some familiar approaches are to critique the philosophical underpinnings of religious ideology or to make a case from the perspective of scientific evidence and the physical laws of reality. The book we're looking at today, Inventing God, Psychology of Belief, and the Rise of Secular Spirituality by John Mills, argues from the perspective of psychology and posits that God is a psychological creation signifying ultimate ideality. In other words, he is the ultimate wish fulfillment, the forgiving all-powerful father you always wanted, the absolution of all your fears, the antidote to death. Mills writes that the conception of God is the manifestation of humanity's denial and response to natural deprivation. Dr. John Mills is a philosopher, psychoanalyst, and clinical psychologist. He is professor of psychology and psychoanalysis at the Adler Graduate Professional School in Toronto, and is the author of many books in philosophy, psychoanalysis, and psychology. Recipient of many awards for his scholarship, he received the Otto Weininger Memorial Award for Lifetime Achievement in 2015, given by the Canadian Psychological Association. He runs a mental health corporation in Ontario, Canada, and he is here with me today to tell us more about his book. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Secularism. I'm the new host of the channel, Carrie Lynn Evans, and today we'll be talking to Dr. John Mills about his new book, Inventing God, Psychology of Belief, and the Rise of Secular Spirituality. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Well, yes. I guess by trade or by profession, I make my living as a psychologist. But I'm also a philosopher, having earned a PhD in that field, as well as a board-certified psychoanalyst. And I'm also a professor at a graduate program in Toronto. And I run a mental health corporation in Ontario, which is my main profession, but helps me subsidize my scholarship as well.
Sounds good. How did you end up in your field?
I think like anything else, we are ultimately unconsciously drawn to why we go into a particular discipline. So in my youth, I think I felt the need to go into psychology because I wanted to help people, only to realize I was there for my own selfish motives. To understand myself, and that led me into more of a love of knowledge, and I ended up going into philosophy after that, and not securing an academic job, given how difficult the field is to get employed in philosophy. I fell back on my original, training, and that's where we're at today.
Well, it sounds like a good mix. So my next question for you then is, how did you end up coming to write this book in particular?
Well, again, I believe that these things are ultimately psychologically motivated. It wasn't something that I deliberately thought I was going to do at first, but having my own personal experiences growing up, I was raised as a Christian, and so also gravitated toward youth groups in my teens as a way around the church and a way of connecting with my peers.
Right.
By the time I would say reached the age of reason, the whole God posit started to fall apart on me, and I would say I spent most of my 20s as an agnostic, and then I realized that I just couldn't sit on the fence any longer, and so I think when I went into my my philosophy PhD studies is when I really started to come to terms with this issue more head on. And yet at the same time, I feel and felt internally divided, because on one hand, I think that there's a primal dimension to us that seeks out certain types of spiritual experiences, if we want to call it that. But what do you do when you can't buy into the religious doctrine that's grafted on our own internal needs or pulsions? So I think that's why I gravitated toward metaphysics, probably as a substitute for religion, unconsciously. And through that, I decided I really need to take a long look at the matter, and started to think that I'm going to then address this as a more, you know, philosophical topic, and which led to eventually writing the book.
Excellent. Yeah, I can identify with a lot of those same feelings. I grew up in a religious family as well, and was also of the proclivity to just not really buy it. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. So in your book, you begin by being concerned to differentiate between the critique of religion as a social practice and the questioning of the existence of a god or God. So do you want to just outline for our audience that difference there?
Well, yes, I think I'm not so much interested in the question of religion as I am in the concept of God. And I don't think the two are the same, even though it's easy for, I think, for people to conflate them. But I also don't want to ontologically separate the two. For instance, the question or the predication of God can be entirely different from a religious practice. However, most religious practices or faiths or organized, modes of religious being, particularly in the monotheisms, necessarily have to have a Godhead. But there are other forms of religions that don't necessarily have a God. I mean, certain aspects of Buddhism or Shinto or other types of non-monotheistic Abrahamic religions. So I like to separate the two, at least categorically. And the book is more about the ontological question of God's existence, however we want to define what that is.
Yes. Excellent. And you mentioned that in your opinion, that the current body of atheist literature tends to overlook the psychological aspects that give rise to people's sensation of a need for God.
Yes, if you read within the last decade or so, the new atheism literature, which really hit, with the trade presses, hit the public in a wave. With Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett and
Christopher Hitchens.
Exactly. Even though there's very fine arguments and a consciousness raising aspect to this, if you read the work, really there's no engagement with the psychological dimensions. And so I felt that illuminating the internal psychodynamic parameters of the need or wish to believe was lacking, and that's why I feel I have something novel to contribute to the discourse.
Excellent. Okay, and you also comment that you feel that scholarly religious studies often take God's existence for granted rather than attempting to grapple with how an argument could be credibly made. In chapter one, you address the notion of God as a metaphysical question and lay out your arguments for why, as you put it, the God posit is a failed hypothesis. Can you explain that term a little more, perhaps?
Well, it's a complex matter. So the thought that I was struck by the theological literature and the philosophy of religion literature, where we can simply presume the very thing in question in all of our writings, and so. In my research, at least, it seems like even questioning whether or not we can predicate God stopped with St. Thomas Aquinas, and so in his Summa Theologiae is where he sets out certain types of arguments for the existence of God, and then goes about to try to argue for that matter. It's as if the religious institutions, academics, theology have just presumed the very thing that one really has the burden to prove. And so I want to revisit that age-old medieval where the question stopped about 1,000 years ago, and start with basics.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. You also get into the question of how various religions have understood the, quote, person of God. And you suggest that these interpretations arise in part from their unique context and the influence of their unique environmental stressors.
Well, yes, the notion of that God is a person is very it's very monotheistic, but it's typically Christian, and but I should back up. You know, the whole what sets the whole stage for any discussion on God is how we want to define God, and often we can get off on the wrong foot, or we won't be on the right page if we don't agree to a operational definition of what we mean by God. And so for simplicity's sake, it seems that most of the monotheistic religions would want to endorse God as a supreme being and supreme agent and creator of the universe, that is a supra-personal, trans-subjective, supernatural entity. And then there are certain elements that get tacked onto that, such as omni-perfections, omni-attributes, and things like this. And one of them is that God must be not an impersonal force or source or entity, but a personal one. And we see that in all, particularly the Christian traditions. So even, from, Augustine to Aquinas to Anselm to Calvin and to contemporaries such as Alvin Plantinga, Swinburne, things like people like this in the field of philosophy. So if one doesn't want to buy into that discourse, then we're talking about God in a different way. For instance, people can define God in very relativistic ways. I mean, to such a degree that God becomes whatever one wants it to be. And that I just really don't see that as the same kind of definition that most people, meaning that the masses view as God. I mean, God has to be a person in their mind, or a personhood, or an agent. Because why would we worship an impersonal force in the cosmos? However, there are people like Bentley Hart or Karen Armstrong who want to look at God as being itself. Well, when you look at God as being or in a naturalized way, then to me that's really not God. I mean, it doesn't have the same level of exaltation. And so if, you know, it depends upon who my interlocutor is or who I'm discoursing with. If we can agree upon a certain way of viewing God, it usually helps in the discussion. But I would say that the pedestrian notion that most people think of is God as a supernatural, ontological being that has brought the universe and existence into being.
Yes, that's been my experience as well, that it's definitely promoted that the notion of God is a very personal one. You're encouraged to have a personal relationship with God. This is the kind of language that's used. But I think also that stems from Jesus himself. In the Bible, I think he encouraged thinking of God the Father in a very personal way. So when you put it in the light of these psychological factors that you outline in your book, it makes a lot of sense why that would appeal to people. And I think, you know, why it would make the religion so attractive to people, which gave it longevity, right? So, very interesting to look at it from the psychological perspective. In chapter 3, you first tackle the effects of the positive representations of God, such as an idealized wish fulfillment, and how these ideas affect people psychologically. For instance, how the notion defends itself from critical analysis and how it can be used on a broader institutional level as a lever of power.
Well, clearly, God representations are multiple, and they are very idiosyncratic in many ways to the person or the believer who is in relation to their own internal relationship to that internalized representation. And so what representations really are images and introjects and emotional properties that are, internalized in us from very, ever since we're basically born and become organized psychically and typically on unconscious, semiotic and socio-symbolic and emotional levels. And the longer, of course, we live and experience the world, we will incorporate and internalize more and more representations. We first must assume that the most emotionally dominant and important types of internalized representations are based upon our parents or their surrogates. And hence, they become the exemplary prototypes or models by which we then would construct broader social representations. Meaning by that, how do we relate to certain images, certain idealities, certain values, certain feeling states that we place into an internalized object. And so these, for many people, of course, in their upbringing and their education, the notion of God as a object representation is supposed to be an idealized one, a positive one. It signifies what we would like there to be, and that is a perfect, loving, benevolent, beneficent, creator, so to speak. In many ways, this is kind of like what a small child wishes or feels toward their parents. My mother, my father are great, and hence. Here, though, is that we have a supra signifier. We have the uber father. And hence, of course, when we have the personification of of all the things that we value, you know, love, acceptance, validation, an inner sense of peace and tranquility.
Perfect justice as well, I would interject.
Not like here on Earth.
That's right.
So, yeah, to echo your point that these are the positive valences that good representations can serve the theist.
That's right. And you also make an argument for how believers use their belief and faith, just the feeling of their belief and faith, they try to posit as being evidence itself for the existence of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting too, because on one hand, you know, especially my profession and my humanistic attitude toward people, I'm really not in the business of wanting to negate their internal experiences. On the other hand, the more rational or logical or philosophical aspect of my mind will want to ask for some justification or for evidence. And so it is an interesting dialectic that gets played out. On one hand, you have people like in the tradition of Aquinas or Calvin, where the notion that God is in us and God is actually implanted in us, the knowledge of, quote, his existence. And this is typically a faculty or what we can call a sensus divinitatis, that we intuitively have a sense of God's existence. And then you have contemporaries like Alvin Plantinga, who has a notion of reformed epistemology, where he would say that the belief in God is entirely natural, it's intuitive, it's rational, and you don't have to have any evidence or argument for it whatsoever. This is where more of a scientific or rational or empirical, stance would be challenged. But if we were to set that aside for a moment, some of the oldest metaphysical texts that exist are in the Upanishads, and some of the early verses in Indian philosophy, Hindu philosophy, is to posit the notion of a ultimate reality, and that people have a need for that ultimate reality. They want to embrace it. They want to experience it. And that it's the reason why we even have the desire to embrace it is that it must be already there. Or hence, why would we even want it? Of course, this begs the question on what constitutes psychological motivations. But if we think of Aristotle's, opening line in his Metaphysics that, all men by nature desire to know. One could claim that that's a natural faculty, a naturalized psychological faculty. So what is the believer actually getting at when they say, I know that God exists because I feel it internally? And on one hand, I am very sympathetic that something's touching that person. That's beautiful for them. That's the numinous for them and meaningful. And who am I to come in and start, hatcheting that away with my, Western logical, questions. On the other hand, when we do make grandiose metaphysical statements such as that, we have to have some, the burden of proof is on the individual to try to justify that, the belief in or the knowledge of, or the certainty of, that there is this independent ontological being that exists outside of my mind, let alone how would we epistemologically even know that, given that everything we experience is cognitively mediated, psychologically mediated, so we can't even really have a discussion about what exists independent of our mind. But if we were to even to infer it, that's exactly what I think theists are doing, that God has to exist independent of our consciousness, of human beings, and hence there's the automatic assumption in a metaphysical realism. So this is where the refined or reformed epistemologist would at least have to attend to. But in the end, they may say, with my blessing, so to speak, that this is real to me, and this is what makes me feel good, despite the fact that, you know, we open ourselves up to the possibility of a radical subjectivism or egoism or relativism or whatever one wants to say.
Right. One of the points you made that I found really interesting is you explain how the psychological processes that allow one's belief to in fact be strengthened in the face of the absence of evidence. So that absence, that faith, I suppose, actually the less evidence there is almost has this reversed effect of giving them even stronger faith and stronger belief.
Let me try to be sympathetic to that, but first let me be the skeptic. That how is it that we're going to imbue something that we cognitively posit, and then all of a sudden the idea becomes an ontological object in its own right that exists out there, independent of us. And I don't need any evidence for it, because somehow I just feel it, intuit it, so therefore it is. Well, we just can't posit something into existence. We can't think something into being, into actuality. Existence is not a predicate. Predicating something is something that we have to demonstrate through evidence. And so, given that God has not manifested, that has not appeared in some form, has therefore not become actual, the believer then has to cognitively realign themselves with a certain justification of the belief. So the belief, again, could be simply a feeling, a resonance state, an intuition, and that's enough for them, that I can't explain it in words, I won't even try, but nevertheless, it is a divine, mystica. I'm feeling in communion with whatever the Godhead is to be, or the presence is to be. There's other more convoluted arguments, such as the reality of divine hiddenness. So God doesn't have to appear, doesn't have to manifest, doesn't have to have any kind of naturalized signs in the universe. But God is in hiding. God doesn't need to appear. Now there's all kinds of need to attach certain psychological motives to God's non-manifestation, which of course is simply a projection of our own minds onto our experiences or our ideas. How can it be other than that, given that everything is psychologically mediated on some level?
Do you think that kind of response has increased more recently? Because I'm just thinking that you probably don't have to look too far back into our history to find a time when people believed they did see evidence of God more frequently, because they just couldn't interpret weather patterns or other random acts that they or encounters they might have that they might ascribe to a divine sign. So, which I think these days we would be much less inclined to do, just because the public is generally more educated, has a better understanding of science and weather patterns, for one thing. So do you think that that kind of habit is on the rise? Have you noticed any kind of a change in that?
Well, just looking at popular culture, I don't think we're hearing a lot about people talking about divine interventions and miracles that are happening to them so much now. I mean, at least I'm not in touch with that. So much as just the belief, the resurgence of, let's say fundamentalism in the United States, for instance. Of course, you will see this in other parts of the world, in Islam, and the chagrin of the religion when you look at the extreme forms such as the terrorist groups that are happening. But that's not really the point. The point is in the past, of course, people who don't have access to understanding natural phenomenon would be more inclined to import a certain type of hermeneutic or a psychological interpretation that they may not even be aware of, but just simply accept as a sign of a divinity. You can understand how that would, be a mode of explanation, because people who don't have access to knowledge, or our knowledge was more limited in terms of our early evolution as a culture and civilization, that they would gravitate toward these explanations. You even have evolutionary psychology and the psychobiology of religious belief theories that would want to even explain why would people think this way, such as that when we are out in nature or in our own offices or whatever it may be, and we might perceive or misperceive or see things that we think we feel a presence here, may be explained at least on some level that we're equipped with some agency detecting mechanism, which is rather fascinating that we would somehow project certain teleology into our environment, and we see movement and we see images, and then we are quick to want to integrate this into some meaningful narrative or cognitive structure that allows us to function in the moment. And if anyone has been paranoid or fearful, or been out in the woods and you've imagined things, to me that kind of helps explain of how we might have overactive imaginations at work.
Yes, yeah, it really does, because that's true. When you're in a situation, or human beings always have that propensity to find a pattern, perceive a story where there isn't necessarily, right? So no, that's good. Makes a lot of sense. Which kind of leads into my next question. You talk about how these notions of the invisible yet all-knowing, ever-present being can potentially have really negative psychological impacts beginning as early as early childhood.
Yes, I think this is a contextual or contingent question. It depends upon where one was raised, how they were raised, what were they told. And, abuse of teachings can lead to all kinds of psychological, conflicts and unnecessary suffering. Specifically, if you're being, threatened or made to feel afraid or not safe, let alone when you import certain value judgments onto your sense of self as being flawed or sinful or in violation of God's will or a number of things. Of course, seeing people in, you know, in psychological treatment, I of course will see a certain, you know, certain aspect of the population that have usually come in for reasons other than, let's say, the normative population, and some have presented with extremely traumatized, you know, experiences of the teachings of their family and the church, to the point where it's you know, created you know, a crippling state of affairs in their mind, where they're internally divided, where they feel horribly guilty and ashamed, at the same time extremely paranoid and fearful of vengeance and you know, a great deal of unnecessary suffering because of the teachings.
Wow. Well, to move on to chapter 4, you go on to talk about different socioeconomic conditions around the world that tend to lend themselves to either atheism or religiosity, and the positive perspective that you believe secular humanism and spirituality have to offer. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Why, sure. What's very interesting, the fact from epidemiology studies, is that some of the most poorest, impoverished, uneducated, lacking any resources, I mean, most resources that we would just take for granted, have some of the highest faith-based beliefs and practices in the world. And yet some of the most educated, wealthy, industrialized, democratic, and educated populations have higher rates of suicide, who identify themselves as atheists. On the one hand, they have better qualities of life. On the other hand, there's some element of internal depletion and despair. However, let's say certain nations, let's say in Africa, where the most horrendous social conditions exist, have the highest amount of belief and the less amount of suicide. So it tells us from certain just certain parts of the world how the need to believe is so much higher when one is you know, suffering. When one has less, when one's impoverished, when they're under adversities. And in some ways, it's not so surprising because there's more of a stronger defensive process in people. The need for hope, the need for redemption, the need, the promise of when this life of suffering is done, I'm going to get, you know, what I feel I always wanted and deserve. Non-believing, free-thinking, you know, agnostic, atheist, secular, humanistic folk, whatever the hybrid they might fall into, they have to kind of face life on their own terms. There is nothing more than this. You have to make life what it is. And so secular humanism is becoming more popular in certain parts of the world. And I think this is highly correlated with democratization, with education, with culture, with financial success, so to speak. As even Aristotle would say, you really don't have time to lead a contemplative and virtuous life unless you have money. You have to have something. In order to prosper. So, but secular humanism is interpreted differently by, you know, anybody who identifies in that group, just like certain reformed religious, you know, institutions would. So what does it mean? It's hard to really say what it means for everybody, but more of a humanist attitude is certainly going to be based upon a naturalized view of the world, not a supernaturalized or theistic view, that however, let's say we don't believe or don't presume that there is anything other than the natural world which we find, the humanist is inspired by art and human compassion and ethics living in the here and now for people, as well as being informed by reason and science. And in a nutshell, it's like we don't need the big guy in the sky in order to live a good life. And the good life should be enjoyed here, and it should be shared, and it should be cultivated with our fellow human beings. And that's an end in itself.
Exactly. You also use the phrase "in search of the numinous," which correct me if I'm getting this wrong or if I'm missing aspects of it. But basically, the numinous refers to a healthy pursuit of self-actualization, fulfillment, and secular morality. So can you explain to our listeners how you see that search for the numinous as working?
Well, I'll try. The notion of the new, I like the term the numinous. It has a certain emotional appeal to me. It might not mean much to others, but you know, it comes from Rudolf Otto, who was a theologian and philosopher, a German, who was very influential in writing in the early 20th century, a book called The Idea of the Holy. And despite his theology, he's talking about a particular affective and emotional experience that one has in relation to what they call the divine. We can see this coming, the notion of noumen coming from Roman cult philosophy, where there is some notion of a divinity principle that animates the cosmos. However, what I'm trying to get at more is a sense of there is this affective sense of awe that we have in relation to some type of experience. We may call it transcendental. We may call it the sublime. We might call it spiritual, what used to be called religiosity. And I'm not opposed to that term, meaning spirit. I'm not opposed to that or the notion of soul, given that this historically comes from the notion of psyche and that which animates us. So the notion of animus is the animator in us, is what makes us feel alive. It's what gives our sense of self value. And so what is it when we talk about the numinous? Usually these are aspects of experience that are not necessarily normal, but they could be ordinary. They could be ordinary feelings of transcendence, or they could have more of an extra emotional quality that's attached to it. And usually, it's one that has a sense of urgency to it, and also that there's an element of mystery, an element of suspense, and an element of fear that's associated, which gives you a heightened sense of arousal. And so those are the more profound numinous experiences. And of course, they are self-determined. When I speak of self-actualization, I'm really meaning a process of self-discovery, but Jung called it an individuation process, where we're having to undergo our own self-articulated path. And that's to be defined by you, only you. It's a radically subjective enterprise, the pursuit of the numinous.
That's excellent. So you feel that that can really address the needs people have for some element of spirituality in their life, but it's flexible. Did you say that's right?
Yes, I do. In many ways, it is entirely idiosyncratic, but at the same time, it can be identified in certain patterns or in certain identifications that other can share. There's shared meaning about certain events. When people say, spirituality is really about the quality of lived experience. It's really about what I want or feel or I'm pining for. I'm seeking out ultimately. I don't know what that is. I'm just, fumbling through ecstasy, so to speak, and I'm hopefully gonna land on it someday. But, it's the pursuit that counts.
Wonderful. Were there any other points from your book that I've missed that you wanted to have a chance to talk about?
I think there's so many. We've covered a lot of ground here. Hopefully, the message, I think of the certain overall messages here is that despite the fact that I don't believe the Supreme Being exists, and despite the fact that we have certain psychological needs and motives and conflicts both for and against belief, and that they often serve many overdetermined motives and desires and wishes, that in the end, I think one needs to be in touch with that aspect of themselves that wants to feel more alive and feel more in touch with the spiritual. And one does not have to have any belief whatsoever in a transcendent entity in order to achieve that in the here and now. And ultimately, this makes kind of life an existential quest. Spirituality can be achieved in very concrete ways through the way we wish to live our life. Whether that be living life artfully, we are, developing a sense of ethical self-consciousness that we have toward our environment, to our ecosystems, to our societies, to the concrete human beings and people that we encounter every day, our families, our children, our friends, the notion of friendship. There's like so very few people that actually have true friendship. If you look at it, they seem to be more about social acquaintances and appearances, but not in a really deep lived and loved feeling. The notion of pursuing whatever floats your boat. And if it has value to you, that's important. And so I think this is where both the person of, the religious as well as the secular person share a common denominator. And that is what ultimately they feel and the quality of their lived existence is ultimately what matters.
Oh, I think that's such a positive, wonderful note to end on, because I just think that that's such a good message for anybody who's trying to find their way out of a religion or religious practice that they might find a weight or a bit of a burden on them. So thank you so much for that. And thank you, John, for giving us your time today. So before we go, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what you're currently working on.
Sure. My next book is also a grave matter. It's it's on the question of human extinction.
Oh.
Because I'm very concerned about the way the world is these days. Everything from our, you know, our global ecological crisis with the way we are destroying our planet to, you know, the simple bystander effect that we're doing nothing as nations to subvert this disaster that we all see is coming. And people are living in a denial or they're dissociating from these realities. It's as if we know they're there, but I just can't deal with it. And not to mention the fact that we're heading toward a severe overpopulation boon where we'll have predicted about 10 billion people on this planet in our lifetime, where resources will be much more scarce in terms of water, in terms of food, land to grow food, land to put people, not to mention the anathema of evil and all the human aggression that we see being played out throughout the globe, that it really is an ominous time. And I'm pessimistic in the sense that we may be living in the end times. And so not in any biblical sense, in a sense it deserves, I think, a serious study.
One might call it the humanist version of the apocalypse. Sorry. Okay. Well, my goodness. Maybe we'll have a chance to meet again and discuss that one as well. So I want to thank you very much for being on the show today. And I really enjoyed it. I hope you'll come back. And thank you very much, John. Goodbye.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the podcast today. Once again, I'm Carrie Lynn Evans, and I've been speaking with Dr. John Mills about his book, Inventing God, Psychology of Belief, and the Rise of Secular Spirituality. You can find out more about John at his website, www.millspsychology.ca. Be sure to like the New Books in Secularism channel on Facebook and follow the New Books Network on Twitter, where you'll see every time we post a new interview. You can also find me on Twitter at Carrie Lynnland. That's at CarrieLynnland, where I generally post about science fiction and science and tech news. Did you find this book fascinating? Let me know. I'd love to hear what you think. Goodbye until my next conversation about new books in secularism.